Hello and welcome to another episode of the We Have a Meeting podcast. So today we're very, very lucky to be joined by an incredible voice in the world of publishing. So today's guest is responsible for one of my favourite books, The Secret, that's changed millions of lives worldwide. And some of our audience will know that the world of publishing can be a difficult one to get your foot into the door of. So today we're going to uncover some of the secrets within the world of books. I'm honoured to have the president and publisher of the Harper One Group, Judith Kerr. Judith, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Jack, and thank you for having me. I'm excited to share and give you a little inside look into the wonderful world of publishing books.
We love it, we love it. So a lot of our listeners are business owners, entrepreneurs, thought leaders, and they probably, I know a lot of them or some of them would like to write a book or are writing a book at the moment in time. So I guess, Judith, we start our podcast the same way every time. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
Okay, so my name is Judith Kerr. I'm the president and publisher of the Harper One Group, and I've been here at HarperCollins for approaching 6 years. Previous to that, I was the publisher and president of Atria Books, which I founded over at Simon & Schuster, and I was there for like 20 years almost. And prior to that, I'm Australian born, moved to the United States. I was headhunted by Random House. I was a publisher in Australia. And prior to that, I was in cosmetics for Christian Dior, which taught me a great deal about packaging and about presentation and about desire. Mm. And all of those things have come together to inform my publishing universe. So I oversee a group of 4 different imprints, which I'll get into later, and I greenlight the projects, but I also help become the kind of, what is the guiding principle about who we are as publishers, what do we stand for, what kind of relationship do we want to have with our authors, because it's really for them. And the problem I solve is when people say, I have nothing to read, I always have an answer for them.
Okay, good. And then, so I guess if I was one of those people that said, I have nothing to read, where would you send me first? Like, what's your passion or what's the best space to kind of get into?
Well, the first thing that I would ask you is, like, what were the last few books you read that you loved? And that gives me an idea of what kind of basis you are. Do you have a problem you want to have solved? Do you feel down? Do you want to be inspired? Do you want to sort of just be, you know, like have like word candy? And then I would, because it's always really good to know what it is that people are looking for. And in that, I find different books and different authors. And you somewhat, I call myself a story hunter, you know, but I'm also the matchmaker between the author and the reader. And then I get out of the way.
Wonderful. And I suppose if we take it all the way back, you mentioned some previous experience there, which I'm sure was useful when you came to Harper One. But when they brought you in as president, what was the problem they were hoping to solve by bringing you in?
Okay, so I think it was probably a mixture of two things, the problem to solve and the opportunity that presented. So I was asked to come over, and I'd been at Simon & Schuster happily for 20 years, but I was looking to see what could I do that in publishing that was new and that was actually representative of the 21st century and representative of the population of the United States, the mixture of the United States. And at this Harper One, which is in San Francisco, is the cornerstone of our group. And it was the only imprint when I was asked to come over, asked to reinvigorate that imprint and to grow it and to grow and to turn it into a group. And so I had a plan about how to do that. And the 4 pillars of that growth was, one was I wanted to continue publishing for, you know, unrepresented voices. And I had published a lot at Simon & Schuster, African-American authors, books in translation, and I published books in Spanish. And none of those things were present really in any big significant way at HarperCollins. And I thought this is an opportunity to focus on those 4 different pillars, which collectively represent the United States culturally and everything else. So that was the, so the problem was, how do we grow HarperOne? The solution was, well, we can expand out the edges of what HarperOne is, and I can go into that if you want. And then I wanted to add these three other pieces to it that also had the opportunity to grow. One, and I can go, can tell you about those, but once I get started, you know, it's very difficult to... Okay. So the idea that was going to be the group, and there were only people in San Francisco when I came on board, and I work out of the New York office, and this was pre-COVID. So that was lucky because we had a lot of technology and we're used to working long distance and electronically in a way that most other publishers had not been used to. So that gave us a little bit of an opening when COVID came on, well, whatever did appeared. And then so we at HarperCollins, they had Amistad, which is an imprint focused on African Americans and the African diaspora, and is a storied imprint that had been going for 35 years, but it had a very small publishing list. So the idea was to grow and expand that. So there was one editor working on Amistad when I joined, and now we have four editorial people exclusively working on Amistad and representative, obviously, of the Amistad readership. And then I wanted to continue with publishing because at Simon & Schuster, I had done a lot of commercial fiction, you know, and had Jodi Picoult, and I've discovered Colleen Hoover and various people like that. So I wanted to do fiction, but I didn't want to do what I had already done because I had already done that and that could continue on without me. You know, and so I decided I always liked books in translation because I speak no other language other than English, but I really want to hear from all the rest of the world. So having books in translation, you know, you get the opportunity to pick the best of the best because they've already gone through a whole process in their own countries. And so that's HarperVia, and we've published since we first book went on sale in 2019, and we've published 80 titles from 30 countries from 20 different languages, and just quietly doing that. And now I feel like the world is coming. We need to know more about the world. We cannot ignore the fact that there are other countries outside of the borders of the United States and other people falling in love, being murdered, you know, needing inspiration, all of, you know, going to church, all of those different things, just like us. But we do want to know what the differences are and also what it... So the slogan for that one is building empathy through the language of the imagination. So it has a guidance. And then the fourth piece, there is a lot of Spanish-speaking people in the United States and the population is Hispanic, Latinx, etc. And they need information too. And so we publish books that are particularly of interest to people who live in the United States where Spanish is their first language. And that can be fiction, that can be self-help. We've got a book about child raising in the Latin community. Very different kind of cultural backgrounds. And really, it allows everybody to be seen. And then within HarperOne, it's a list that's principally non-fiction, spirituality, diversity in religion, diversity in thinking. And we wanted to broaden out that. And so Lives That Inspire, that's a really interesting way to look at biographies. And, you know, I published Viola Davis. She had something very important to say. So that was a life that inspired. And it fitted alongside the principles that HarperOne in nonfiction represents. So if I'm a nonfiction reader at HarperOne, what fiction may I read? Or what authors do I want? What people's lives do I want to look at? And the other thing that I'm very, growing up in Australia, one of the things I'm very interested in is decolonizing wellness. You know, why should wellness only be for a particular prototype of a person when the world is not just that one person or not just that one group? And what does that really mean? And so collectively, the four imprints come together and our mission, our joint mission, is publishing for the world we want to live in. So it allows us to measure everything that we're publishing against that principle. So does this book contribute to that endeavor, whatever subject it's about, or not? So it's quite easy then for the editorial team to work that out. And then so collectively, then the four imprints, we all work as all four one, you know, a bit of a musketeer approach there. But anyway, I hope that answers the question.
It's good. I love it. It's we're big on what problems do people solve, and it sounds like you're not just, oh, let's get some books out into the world. You're actually solving a problem, which I love. I wanted to talk to you, I mentioned it in the intro, and I wanted to talk to you about The Secret by Rhonda Byrne.
Yes,
so
yeah.
I've heard that you were the guiding force behind publishing that, and it's a well-known
yes.
book in many different languages. Talk me through that book. How did that happen, and what's happened since then?
Okay, so that was when I was at Simon & Schuster in 2006, I think it was, but with Rhonda. So what we, there was a small, everything is connected. So we make small decisions, which we think are insignificant at the moment, but they all lead to something ultimately. And so there's a chain of events which took place. So I published a book, there was a book called The Hidden Messages in Water by Emoto. It's like the idea that water has memory and it and feelings. And so the publisher, a small publisher on the West Coast, a spirituality publisher, was publishing that. And then they were kind of like a self-publisher. And then what happens if you have a big success, that's when you get problems when you're self-publishing or in a smaller environment, because you can't fund the growth. It's a really quick, fast growth that happens. So I went, bought the book from them, but I thought, well, there's no point me just buying all your good books. Why don't we have a partnership? And that was with Beyond Words, and we partnered with them. And then, so we, that was nice, that Dr. Emoto was it's a fantastic project, and it was very successful. And then one of the people at Beyond Words was having dinner with one of their other authors in Seattle, and that author had just been interviewed by a woman called Rhonda Byrne because she was making a documentary about, you know, the law of attraction. So she told them. And because we have this publishing arrangement, they rang me and said, well, we've just heard about this. It sounds really interesting. What do you think? And then we were able to get the some footage from Rhonda's documentary and look at that. And it's like, okay, I can see why that needs to have a book to go with it. But and as soon as I saw their promotional video, I had this kind of feeling, you know, when you get when everything sort of goes on all cylinders, you think, oh, hang on a second. And the book says, you hold in your hand the secret to everything. Now, that's a big promise and a great one. Who doesn't want that? And then and it was not far off after the Da Vinci Code had been, you know, people were thinking about mysticism and religion and exposed to it in a different way. And then, so it just seemed like the perfect project. And as it turns out, Rhonda Byrne is also Australian, and I hadn't been here really that long at that stage. And she felt that the two of us were in the United States to be able to work together on this project. And after we acquired it, with Beyond Words involved as well, after we acquired it, I took the video around that at Simon & Schuster, and I said, like, here, I'm just like, here's a new bestseller. Because I like to have, I like to set an expectation, but never a ceiling, because you should never put a top on anything, but you should open it out. And every week I'd say, you know, this is amazing, you should see this. And we didn't even have the book at that stage because it was written very quickly. Like Rhonda had been writing it, but we produced it very quickly and beautifully. And every single thing is very intentional in that book. Everything. Even the head and tail bands. We sold so many books that the little head and tail bands that you see at the top of a hardcover, there was a small cottage industry. They could not produce enough red ones because the demand was so high. And that was, to me, a sort of significant thing because it shows that books are a kind of an ecosystem of their own, and they give back to the community in unseen ways. So these people had really increased in their business. And it was just so we had, it was very easy. We had ask, believe, receive. And we did, and Rhonda was, we published it, and it did nicely. And then she was on Oprah, and then, but the Oprah was the very last one interview that she really did. because we decided, Rhonda decided, and basically, if you have somebody like Rhonda Byrne, I'm just there to execute what she wants. You know, I have complete and utter faith in what she's doing, and I'm guided by that. So we decided to do no marketing. It's kind of, we'll just let this take its course, because the greatest power is the is in its proof. And the proof is not something we're going to tell you that's going to happen to you. It's you finding out and discovering that it happened to you, and then you tell people. And these days, everything is word of mouth. Everything has a backstory. But at that moment, it didn't really. And we went on to have it like translated in 52, 53 different languages, which is very unusual for nonfiction. Because it's very hard to get 53 languages to all agree about something, particularly when it's sort of esoteric and spiritual, because it resonated with people's hearts. And then when I left, we'd sold about 35 million or so. But when I came over to Harper with Harper One, and we had the pandemic, Rhonda called me and said she had a project, and she wanted to do it with me. And it was, but we had to publish it. This was April. She hadn't written it. And we have to go on sale in November. And we want to go in as many countries as possible simultaneously. And it's going to be, you know, that's it. And we're in the pandemic, in lockdown. So I said yes. And see, the power of yes is super important. No is easy. Yes takes courage. So it is called The Greatest Secret, and so we managed to do that, and it's been amazing. And we've sold just quietly through in the United States so far 365,000 copies, and The Greatest Secret is amazing. So I recommend that. But that was her gift to me too, I think, because all of the brand of The Secret is over at Simon and Schuster, where we worked very closely together for all those years. And then The Greatest Secret was, I was able to do all that we could work in shorthand and get everything done.
I've noticed something in this conversation, Judith, and I don't know if this is taking from The Secret, but the language you've used in your career, I just picked up on something you said then when you brought the book in, you said, this is the new bestseller. It's very definitive language. It's not, this might be the new bestseller, maybe I'm onto something. It's very, very firm language. Is there something in that? Is there something in believing those stories and putting those kind of positive messages out there?
Yes. Well, it's worked for me, and I believe that unless you have the dream or the intention, you can't actually have the reality. And if the reality has a different timeline or has a manifestation in a different way, then so be it. But it's like you have to be clear. What do you want? And I think this is good for authors too. You know, I know that you might have some listeners who are interested to know if there's any secret to things. But really, it's like, what is your intention? And if you want to write a book, so what is your purpose with it? Do I want to have fame? Do I want to make money? Do I want to, have the creative experience? Do I want to have something to share with my family? To be clear with your intention. And then, and also to trust that it will come through. If it's too, you can write for a particular audience and you can write for a particular aim, but unless there's something of you on those pages in whichever, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, and then it doesn't ring true for people. So authenticity is a great gift to give people. And these days it's something that books which are kind of discrete containers that you can't interfere with once you own it, and you know that it's a particular point of view and it's a particular thing that's promised you something, and you'll be the judge by the time you've finished it whether it achieved that goal. But you can't do that unless you want to be open and truthful and intentional with your readers.
Okay, and that leads nicely into our next question, actually. One of the things that I'm fascinated by is, to me as an outsider, storytelling and writing looks subjective. So it looks like something that you might love as a story, Jack might not, and I might love. So there's some subjective element to it, but then there must be things that are universal, that is the makeup of a good story, and I know it when I see it in your experience with all the authors that you've discovered and helped. So what are those things that just every time they work?
Well, there aren't any. There aren't any, like, there's no like magic formula like that. But there's a, but what, here's what I think about stories, particularly in this contemporary universe. So the everything has a story, you know. We're telling a story as we have this conversation. It may be about a particular subject, and it's a, only it would not make a good book, but it's definitely an entree. So I think of stories nowadays as like what the story is the center. And as it relates to books, let's say, the story is the center. And, you know, if you think about it as the wheel of awesomeness, and so everybody can get to the center via the spokes in the wheel of awesomeness by whatever medium they like to consume their story. It may just be at the conversation table. It may be an audio book. It may be a comic. It may be a film. It may be a TV show. It may be a podcast. It may be printed on a page. So, but the story is the key, and we all, the story is the universal thing, and the way we consume it is probably the individual piece. But there may be, you know, like lots of intersecting wheels of awesomeness, and sometimes one book or one story will radiate towards many different circles. I published a book early, just recently at HarperOne, one of the first ones I acquired, called The Boy, the Mole, the Fox, and the Horse. And I don't know whether you're familiar with that, but it's great.
It's brilliant. Every
It's
Christmas,
brilliant.
it's on the TV around Christmas time. Great book.
Yeah, and won an Academy Award for a short for that. But so that's like when I bought that book when I went to London to the book fair, and I was working, I was go and see people, and this just happened to me. It's not, everything's not about me, but when I so Ebury, they showed me three postcards, which were like drawings from Charlie's Instagram, which wasn't that high at the moment. And one of them said, "The boy, the fox said to the, I might get the characters wrong, but the horse said to the boy, 'What do you want to be when you grow up?' And the boy says, 'To be kind.' And the horse says to the boy, 'What's the bravest thing you have ever done?' And that's to ask for help," says the boy. And then and the mole says, "I love cake." So, those three things told me that there was something really special going on here. The relationships and these characters are obviously proxy for things. So I said, "Don't sell this to anyone else. You've got to sell it to me." But there's things that there's formalities that one has to go through. Meanwhile, when I went to shopping in London, I went into a store, a clothing store, and there's a poster of one of Charlie's drawings in the shop. It's like, well, what's that doing here? Those two things are so, such worlds apart. That's an interesting bit of information for me to put in the back of my head. And anyway, then I came back and I showed people. I said, "Oh, you're going to love this. You're going to love this." And not everybody, you know, could see it or understood, but we kept going. We bought the book. We were able to buy the book. We published it quite alongside the UK and started with 10,000 copies. Now, that's not like huge at all, but it's a start. See, the thing is with publishing, you just to exist is something. For the book to exist is a beginning. And anyway, we've gone on now, and we did that, and we did three different editions because it was so lovely. But just with the spine of the book, the cloth binding, we did a red one for Christmas, then we did a green one, and then I thought everyone's a bit upset and depressed, and spring is coming during COVID. And Charlie did a lovely little drawing, which we put into a new edition of a little boy smelling a daffodil, and we put yellow on that. So then the idea was that we had a rainbow of spines that everyone in their family could have one and not get them mixed up with their brothers or sisters or parents. Anyway, so it's been fun.
I love that, and I love hearing the story behind. I've got a copy of that one on my bookshelf at home, so it's nice to hear the story of how they actually end up there. For many aspiring authors, they probably know it's a long, hard road ahead. So before somebody journeys on down that path, what do you think they should know, and what's important, and what would be valuable before they start that journey?
They should know that it's not for the faint of heart. You know, it's kind of like a hero journey, if you like. To know what your intention is, what do you want to achieve, and not to expect to be able to be like the 100-point scorer first time on the court. You know, because that's one of the, there's lots of myths and fables and stories of, you know, breakout successes, of course. But it doesn't necessarily mean that if that doesn't happen to you, then you haven't succeeded. So making sure you know what your own expectation is and what are the markers along the way that will give you encouragement to continue. Because it's sort of a marathon, and some people take many, many years to do it, and some people quite quickly. But there are business reasons to do it too. So you may be a small business owner who has an amazing line of cupcakes that you've invented and that you've got together, and then you think, well, I want to put that into a book because I think it would be great for my customers, and I feel like I've got some new magic to it. And each one of them, because I had this idea to have karaoke cupcakes, food that sings, and to put, like, you know, QR codes on the icing. Then you send your message through the icing to your friend, and then it's like, oh, happy birthday or whatever. So say if I did really do that, then that would be an opportunity to put together a little book with a nice recipes and a little poem or something for the friend, and it's like a gift-giving thing, and it's lovely, and people would like it or not. So there's that kind of publishing. And also for business leaders, we do a lot of books from, you know, in HarperOne, like Do Hard Things, Stephen Magnus' book, you know. We're very, you know, books like, I know within HarperCollins, you've had like Don't Settle for Less, projects like that. And that really is like, what's your business secret, or not secret, what's the lesson that you have learned that you really want to share with people? And it's not just to have a product to sell, but it's because you really have something that you feel you want to talk about and say, and you can do it in a concise way. So there's many different kinds of opportunities and books, if that helps. But
yeah, 1,000,000%. Yeah. It's not for the faint-hearted.
Making clear what your intentions are, and you know, there's lots of books about how to write, and lots of books about that. So you can hone your skills, and you can also hire people to help you if you've got a message, but you're not have the ability or the time to actually sit down and put it all on paper specifically. So there's many different ways to achieve the goal, but it's basically having an idea that you want to share with others.
Yeah, I think you were saying something really interesting there, that there's some books that just break out and they have huge success off the back, and I think of Mark Manson's The Subtle Art when I think
yes.
of that. What do you think, those books that just break out, is it because they're so different? Is it right time, right place, a bit of luck? Is it the quality of the writing? What do you think makes one of those X Factor breakout stars?
I think it's all of those things, actually. And they may not happen at the same time. They may be sequential things. You know, so the thing about books is to be patient. And that... I sometimes categorize books for people here, and I say, well, you know, this is a wild card. This is the one that lightning can strike. But lightning will only strike those things that have some conductivity. It looks like a random event, but it's not really. It's actually, you've already got something in you that's going to attract the lightning. So it's being, and being patient. And we have a few books that have done that kind of, you know, I published, when I was in Australia, I published a book called The Celestine Prophecy. And that was a self-published book. It was a long time ago now. It was a self-published book. And it's about synchronicity, but it's fiction, but it's about the non-fiction principles of New Age, let's say. And for the first time, they're written in a novel. And so that was, people could identify them, see themselves in something that they hadn't seen before, rather than just non-fiction. And two people sent me a copy. One came from England and one came from America, and they both arrived on the same day with a note that said, this is more your bag than ours, and the book is about synchronicity. And then I thought, well, who am I to argue with all of this? So it's about being open too. So for the reader, for the person to write their story, and then to be patient, and then to know that maybe there are three stories in you, and maybe the third one will have that electricity, or maybe it won't be until you're 100 and the people rediscover you.
And you touched on it briefly before, but if someone is, they're a storyteller, maybe it's short story, something as small as documenting their journey on LinkedIn as they're starting a business, but they're just looking to become better at storytelling. How do they hone those skills? Where's a good place to start?
Well, that's by telling stories would help. You know, in a way, like we've been telling stories to each other. You pick something. So I'm a really big fan of like the story behind the story. So you could sort of say, we're publishing a book, for example, with Common, and it's called We Shall Rise. It's a new look about self-care. Now, there's one little scene in that book where Common is a 12-year-old boy, and his father got him a job at the basketball, wiping, you know, in between games, wiping the player's sweat off the court. So that's sort of like a great thing for a young boy in Chicago to have. And then Michael Jordan played his first game for the Chicago Bulls right there. And someone took a photo of Michael Jordan doing a big leap, and Common there as a 12-year-old boy with his towels with the sweat, looking up at admiration. And they send a note to say, two great things coming out of Chicago. So that's a tiny little bit of the book, but now I'm super interested in that story. And so find the story that's adjacent, that lets people into your story. Don't try and give them... Storytelling is not a show. It's not about telling people what happened. It's the opposite of being a witness.
I feel like there's more in that.
It's like...
I feel like there's more in that than I might have interrupted your thought, but that was... Keep going.
Oh, sorry. In which piece? In being the witness?
Yeah, that was interesting.
Yeah. So it's not about like retelling. You're not in the courtroom, and you're not under oath. You don't tell them exactly what happened. Now, I have been accused of exaggerating slightly from time to time, but I do it in the cause of a good story. So embellishment is acceptable, provided you're not in the court of law. So you can practice those kind of things. You can try them out on your friend. I try out stories with people. I mean, not that I'm the story, but I'm the carrier of the story. I'm the sort of the... And I've witnessed people do that. So when we have authors in here, you can tell they're not when they're telling a story about how they got to do something. The pin doesn't... You can't hear anything because everybody is super interested. And others not so much. But the thing is to be a great listener, and also when you're watching TV or you're listening to different things, what is the construct? Like, okay, comedians are great. They always start with a little random thing. You think it's never going to happen, but you know that's going to be their last reference point of the night. You know, they all circle back around and they sort of lead you into it and they try and tease you to it. But ultimately, there's a theme they come back to, and that's their farewell piece. So that's a really interesting storytelling arc that you can learn something from. That you can learn something from the things you read yourself and that you're interested, and the thing that you read all the way to the last page, as opposed to the thing that you put aside and never went back to. You can read all of the reviews of different things, of areas that you're interested in on Amazon, and see what it is that people say about that project or that book that appeals to them. And then ultimately you'll see how do those things come out when I tell my stories, when I write my stories. So there's clues everywhere. You just have your eyes open, have your heart open, and your ears as well. And then, of course, your mouth, because that's where the story comes from.
It's lovely to hear you so passionate. Like, I probably should have expected it, but it probably, from an outsider's point of view, sometimes you think publisher, and you probably think it's just somebody that gets the books out there, but it's great to hear the passion behind it. I wanted to ask you about, obviously we're in the modern era where I could go on Amazon and I could throw anything out there and self-publish it. Publishing, self-publishing, what are the pros and cons of each?
Okay, so there are two different defining things, really, which is not about the story at all. It's like with self-publishing, you fund it. With publishing, the publisher funds it. That's really basic. That's a quick, easy definition. Now, of course, with self-publishing, if you get something that sells like crazy, you make more money than if you do necessarily through a publisher. But you also have to fund. You have to fund it. And is self-publishing can be a step into a publishing company because we look at things that have been selling, like I mentioned briefly before, Colleen Hoover. We decided that one of our business objectives at that time was to find more self-published authors who would benefit by the skills of a publisher and the distribution of the publisher. And we approached Colleen Hoover, and now you know that worked. But it worked for her too because it allowed her to spend all her time and energy writing the books and not having to do the distribution and not to be able to have to deal with all the customers, etc., but to be able to deal with the readers. So that's one of the distinction. And I think there's a really good opportunity for self-publishing as well. There's no reason you can't self-publish, get all the comments from Amazon, and then go back and rewrite your book. No one said you have to stay with it as it is. So that's a learning. And in publishing, there are downsides of publishing because it doesn't necessarily mean it will sell any better, but you do get distribution. But there's a lot of people in the decision-making chain as well.
Have you found,
So.
because I probably don't know enough about this, but do you find that with the music industry and the way that the industry is changing, obviously record deals were a lot easier to come by back then because they'd take a punt on anything, but now there has to be concrete evidence because you can do it yourself. Is that the same in the world of books and publishing? Like, do you look for more, is this going to be a success? Is it more of a business decision, or are you able to still make punts on feeling and you know what, I feel this, I'm going to run for? And if so, what is it you specifically look for?
So yes to all of those actually, but I'll go with the more mystic approach, the last one, if you like me. So okay, so you have a hunch. So we have this wonderful book at the moment. It's a novel. We're going to publish it in April. It's called The Magical Girl Retires, which has been translated from Korean. And in the world of anime, there the magical girl and the anime exist somewhat. But this is a narrative story, and it's about a young girl who's thinking of committing suicide, but she might have another piece of cake, more or less. So, but then she realizes she can't commit suicide because she has to save the world. And that's where the magical girl part comes into it. It's a beautiful novel. It's about 150 pages. But it's somewhere between manga and a novel. It has the anime in it. And it's also very pretty. And I was in London recently. I saw all the cake shops with all the lovely, icing, and everybody there taking photos and Instagramming. And it's like, well, that's sort of an anime kind of, in real life scenario. So we decided to package it in a very special way. So when you take off the jacket, you have this beautiful illustration of the magical girl, hoping that when magical girls everywhere see that book, they'll recognize each other. And I feel that with that book, so we bought the book, and we've got a fantastic young editor here who reads in Japanese and is very anime manga kind of savvy, but it didn't really fit on a stool. So therefore, let's create a new stool for that. Let's say it's, between 16 and 28 would be the readership for this book. Now, it used to be new adult, but why don't we come up with something new? I haven't thought of it yet. And it's a river. So we have something that's really brilliant. We translate it from Korean. It's a punt. But then when you read it, and then when you look about, and then you see the success of things from Korea, you see the comic book market, but all of those people are growing up a little bit. Now they have to deal with adult things. And Colleen Hoover is all about growing up and emotional maturity when you don't really want to quite get there yet. So have we discovered a new area of marketing and publishing? So we take a punt on that, and we take a punt on doing something to see if we can execute that and to see if there's something. Because people will love the book. Now, how many will love it is not really the exercise. It's to see if there's an audience that we can reach in a new way. But the best way to do that is to treat the publication as your market research, not as your finite thing. So that's one way of approaching it, if that makes sense.
Makes perfect sense, yeah. So I suppose the works that you put out have been so eclectic, it must be incredibly hard to split up personal preference and remain completely impartial when it comes to looking for talent. Is that possible, or does personal preference always sneak in a little bit?
Well, of course, we are all, humans, and so we do have personal preferences like embedded in us. But it's not like so you have obviously the personal preferences that I've created this all for one publishing for the world we want to live in these four different areas. So within that, I don't have to resonate with every single book. But I do know that the book is going to be, A, is the author passionate about what they're doing? Are they authentic with what they want to achieve? Does the book do what it promises to do at the beginning of the book? And if it's about a subject that will not be of interest to me as a person, but the execution of it is good, and I know five people who will really love it, then I don't, doesn't matter what I think. I jokingly say I come from a very large family. I have six brothers and sisters, 28, no, yeah, 28 nieces, no, 18 nieces and nephews, and 31 great nieces and nephews. And I think, well, what am I going to give them all for Christmas? So it's a really wide cross-section of people, all ages, all different places, living in different parts of the world. But if I can provide, something for each of those people, I've pretty much covered a wide section of the universe. So I sort of think about it like that. It's like not what do I think about it, but what were the people I know, or what were the readers that we're looking for? Because we look at the readerships, we look at the marketplaces, we look to see what's not there, we look for a voice that's not heard. We published a really excellent book called The Seven Circles of Wellness with Tosh Collins and Chelsea Luger. They're First Nations young couple in America, and it's about the using the seven circles for all the different communities, social, food, nutrition, and they're gifting them to the people who are not First Nations to say there's something from our culture that you could use to help you have a better life. And so I know that there's a great message for the community, but then there is this other area that may be able to tap into that. So they're very so. And then I look at the data and say, well, how many people are here? How many people are there? But, and you can't always look, you can't always look behind yourself to see the future.
Judith, I could listen to you all day. I think it's been
Yeah.
brilliant you coming on, and I think there's definitely been some tangible takeaways for our audience. Can I give you four quick fire questions to end the conversation on?
Yes, you can.
Okay. The first one is your favorite non-fiction book.
Oh, well, I'll say The Secret because it's been so thrilling for me my whole life. It's changed things. And my second would have to be The Boy, the Mole, Fox and the Horse because it sort of adds to the complement of how to tell stories in many different ways to many people.
Okay. I feel like those books might come up with my next questions, but let's see.
Okay.
What's your favorite fiction book?
The one I really liked, I have to say, because it was this Seven Little Australians.
I've not heard of that one. I'll have to check it
No,
out.
you wouldn't. As a young girl growing up in Australia, with all our books coming from England, to have an Australian girl my age and, hanging out in the sunshine at Christmas was really eye-opening. So I always think of that as kind of a world opener. At the same time, it signifies that your life is important too, as well as all these others out there.
I like it. The book that changed your life.
Oh, you know what I think? I think the book that actually changed my career. I've always been a huge reader, right from the very beginning. So there's many, 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 many books. But the book that I think from a professional point of view that changed my career was a big biography I did in Australia on Kerry Packer, called The Rise and Rise of Kerry Packer, because it was, people said they didn't, they had a lot of obstacles around it, and we were able to overcome them. It became a huge bestseller, and not for that reason, but it gave me a leg up, and then I was invited to stand for public office because of that book, wow. Just which I didn't, at the same time as invited to come to America, but I didn't get in, but my ego wasn't hurt because they said, well, I have to leave anyway, I'm going to America. But sort of, as I said, things have a kind of a rolling on effect. So I would say that.
Good. The book that everybody needs to read.
Oh, the one that speaks to them loudest. You know, I publish for all kind of every circumstance. The thing is, or the person whose opinion they love the most or respect the most, the one they recommend to them, the book that they've always had in the back of their mind that, oh, I know, you know, I've been meaning to read that. Because you don't know it's going to be important to you until you've read it.
Mm. And the last one, if you were to write a book, what would you write a book about, Judith?
Oh, you know, that's funny. I probably wouldn't write a book, but you know, I have a hobby, which is I take stones, like stones on the beach, and I stick crystals on them, and I make them into a crystal rock, and I put them in the garden because I like surprises. I like to have people have surprises, and they walk through the garden, they see this rainbow, and recently when people come, they always want one. So I make them for people, and I try to put the colours in there that remind me of them and have their spirit in them and all of that. And when you put it under the window, the light reflects. And I thought that might be a metaphor for actually a storytelling device to write something about something.
I love it. Judith, thank you so much for joining us. If people want to check you out or find out more about you or learn about you or get in touch, how do they do that?
Well, they could put something on our website, HarperCollins, or I have a little Instagram, but I only do little videos of animals in nature because it's super important for people.